Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctegal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We're here in the KHOI studio in beautiful downtown Ames. And we're going to be talking about recipes today. Not specific recipes, but the recipe, those words that tell us what to do in the kitchen. Donna has a few things to say about how to take culinary advice with a grain of salt. But first, we'll also look at garlic, tomatoes, and Donna's adventures with shrub. But first, we'll have a look at what happened this weekend. We had a lovely weekend. The weather was fantastic. Farmers markets are booming. And on Sunday, there was a great local food event here in central Iowa that celebrated farms, food, and the great outdoors. There was something called the local food cycle that happened here around Ames, combining people that like to bicycle and these same people like to eat. The bicycles connected the people to a bunch of local farms. The farm that I live on, Onion Creek Farm, was involved in this food cycle. And originally when we agreed to do this project, they said, oh, well, it'll be about 40 bicyclists show up. Don't worry, we'll take care of anything. Because what happened was that they had caterers and chefs from all over that came and cooked for people. No worries there. But the 40 cyclists soon turned into, when it came to be the day of the ride, about 150. It was a wonderful party, sort of not quite rag-bry. It wasn't quite that rowdy. It was really fun, and the food was lovely. This event was put on by Prairie Rivers of Iowa. Prairie Rivers is a nonprofit organization that is committed to strengthening Iowa's communities through responsible stewardship of natural resources. And they worked with the Story County Conservation to put on this event. They organized this 40-mile bicycle ride to celebrate healthy, sustainable food systems in central Iowa.
And right, and how many farms did they visit? It's quite extraordinary that many people turned out.
There were 8 locations that people started at and ended up at. The sub-theme of the local food cycle is called Bike, Eat, and Repeat. That happened all day on Sunday, and it was a lovely day. I talked to Ruth Powell, who was the driving force at Prairie Rivers, who kind of got this whole thing together. And she said this idea and this sort of a bike ride has happened for a few years already in Iowa City. There it's called the Culinary Cruise, and I believe the Iowa City bike ride is happening in 2 weeks. How it works is that people pay money to cover the cost of the food.
I think it was about $45.
About $45, yeah.
For a lot of really good food.
Oh, and it was all organized and well supplied with kibos and all sorts of things and signs, and it was fine. The whole thing started out in Moore Memorial Park.
Is that in Ames?
That's in Ames.
Okay.
They had coffee and juice there by Liz Jeffrey of Arcadia Coffee. And then they came to Onion Creek Farm, where I live with my husband Joe, when they were breakfast burritos.
And they were delicious.
They were delicious. And we provided a few things from the farm to go in there. I don't have 150 bicyclists worth of eggs to provide that many burritos. So we got some supplementary eggs from Olson Family Farm. And that was catered by Kirby and Katie Height from the Sweet Magnolia caterers from Des Moines. Then they went to a place called Schwartz Wetland up northwest of Ames, Kent and Audrey Schwartz. And they got a cold drink and granola bars by caterer Christiana Langberg. Then they went west, kind of over into Boone County. Red Granite Farms, Steve and Nicole Jonas. And they had Pizza Rustica by Robin Anderson from the Bistro in Story City. She does a good job. Then they backed up a little bit, came back toward Ames, and stopped at the Mustard Seed Community Farm Alice McGarry is out there, and they had fresh salad and sandwiches made by the ISU dining folks, Chef Scott Brune and sous chef Nolan Green.
I mean, I bet that was really good. There
was
a couple of good chefs there.
Pretty good. And it was it's a lovely little farm out there, too. They have lots of fruit trees and prairie. It's lovely to see. Then they went a little closer east, Fisher's Flower and Produce, Joyce and Judy Fisher, with a ginger raspberry tart provided by the cafe. Then up to Prairie Bloom Farm, Elliot Thompson, Lindsay Neeson, and had watermelon from the Reinhardt Family Farm in Boone. And then they ended up at the Prairie Moon Winery, north of town, which is run by Janet and Steve Nissen, for their weekly Sunday concert and a complimentary glass of sangria. It was a great success, and there was fun and full bellies for all. It was a lovely time.
And we hope that'll be an annual event.
Yes, I hope it is.
So watch for it next year. That's why we're telling you about it, even though it's already happened, so that you can plan on joining it next year.
Yes, there were all kinds of people that helped with this event, too. The bicycle support crews in town, the people that provided the logistics and the signage and bringing water around and everything.
It was altogether very pleasant.
Yes, and people came and went and toured farms, mm-hmm. and it was kind of a self-directed tour. So
that means it was not a race.
No, it was not a race. Neither the eating nor the bicycling was a race. So it was a 40-mile culinary experience. What a nice thing to do. Well, like I told you, Donna has a few things to say about how to take culinary advice with a grain of salt. Take it away, Donna.
Well, I had a piece that I wrote for a cookbook, I don't know, golly, more than 10 years ago. And I called it The Tyranny of the Recipe. And really, I wrote it as an introduction to the recipes that I was writing in the book. And partially I did that because when I write a recipe, I try not to make it so precise that you have to have this ingredient and run out to the store and buy it if you don't have it. And I think as I write recipes, I personally want the recipe to be a kind of a loose-knit structure that encourages one to explore and taste and rely upon one's own judgment. And this was written, you know, more than 10 years ago, and I think it's only intensified, like, because people watch a lot of food television and, you know, somehow a lot of cookbooks have become what I call food porn, which means they set impossible standards. They have beautiful pictures and really, in some senses, even though they're most meant to be encouraging, I think what they do sometimes is they discourage one about one's own ability and one's own creativity. It's much in the way if somebody is watching too much porn, they start to denigrate the reality of the body that they have and the people around them. You know, it's like some kind of impossible standard. So what I want to do is, you know, I'll read just a little bit of this, but I wrote, recipes are useful guidelines, especially if family culinary traditions have been obscured by a recent generation or two that didn't really enjoy hanging out in the kitchen, eating, and blessing together. But to really understand, enjoy cooking and food, forget about being a slave to the recipe. So basically, recipes are cooking methodologies founded like a map, kind of, or a treasure hunt or something. You still have to find your own way. And I think a good recipe will either tell you something about maybe the cultural traditions and heritage of something, or even maybe basic nutrition and how to handle certain produce or provenance or something like that.
I find the best cookbooks have got the stories about them.
Yes, exactly. And
even when you get a recipe from a friend, the story behind the food is often the best part. That's what makes you hungry.
Yeah, and I think historically, first of all, recipes have only really been written down predominantly
Well, there were some maybe 1850s cookbooks, but more, it's really more a 20th century invention. You know, our foremothers and fathers, our ancestral mothers, cooked agriculturally, kind of based on geography, weather patterns, where they came from, the communities they lived in, and there were no food fashions. People cooked consistently, mostly the same kinds of things for hundreds and hundreds of years and many, many generations. So you really learn from it. It was passed down as an oral tradition, much like any other craft. You kind of watched and learned, and the main thing is tasting. You know, I'm what I call a tasting cook. I see these people who turn out food and they haven't tasted the whole thing. They're just kind of following the list of things. So when I'm cooking, I keep a whole pile of spoons next to me to dip in and take a taste at almost every step of the way. My most basic instruction really is to taste as you go along. If the flavor pleases you, it will taste good to other people. I often get asked, I think this is the most frequent question, is how long should I cook it? And I go, my answer is, cook it till it's done.
That's true.
Well, because even in a, you know, a very formal recipe, when they set up they'll give you a temperature and they'll give you a time. However, there are so many variables. First of all, hardly anyone's oven is really the temperature that it says it is. And also, you know, things like humidity and weather and moisture content and, you know, air pressure. All of these are variables. So I noticed one thing when I'm cooking, just before something starts to be done, especially if it's in the oven, but not just in the oven, there's a smell that comes out of it. And you know that smell because all of a sudden you go, oh, it's starting to smell like you think it's supposed to.
Or, oh, did I forget it? Or did I? Well, maybe I better look.
No, that's,
oh, that's too far.
When it's
too
late,
okay.
Right? When it first starts to smell really good is when it's very close to being done. And that's when you kind of need to start watching. Like a professional chef can... Oh, like for cooking meat, you can, or fish even, you can press on the meat or the fish with your thumb and know by the feel of it, just if it's medium rare or if it's at the right, you know, or sometimes just poking a fork in it, how easily does the fork go in? You know, these are tactile things that I would encourage you to do. Taste it, feel it, poke it.
Look
you
at
know,
it.
You
yes,
know, all of
yes.
that. That kind of thing. What I do, the only cookbook I really, really recommend is, of course, The Joy of Cooking. I think it has every basic thing that most Americans would really, really want. And they give you kind of a good starting point, you know. And then one thing I often do in any recipe that I'm reading that's printed is I will up the herb and spice content. Not the salt, but, and there are only a few herbs that you can have too much of. Like, you can use too much rosemary, for example. What else can you use too much of that you could really overdose on? Not very many things.
Cayenne pepper.
Oh, yes, that's a very individual thing. The heat of a dish is.
Yeah, the heat of the dish.
Is pretty.
Yes, this idea of trusting your senses. After all, the whole idea of this is to feed ourselves. I don't think we have lost the ability to know what's good for us, even though we may be really out of practice.
Well, and it's also, cooking is a very creative process. So if you're using your own sensory apparatus, your smeller and your taster, to kind of make a creation, you own it. It's kind of like painting, I think, in some senses, only it disappears immediately and it doesn't have to go in a frame on the wall. But it's like you're saying, this is my taste. And that word taste has many meanings other than the literal, but this is so literal. And I think it's more of a pleasure if you're cooking it the way you want to. And you can enjoy that and you can offer it to your friends and your family with your own confidence and your own pleasure in the cooking, you know. So it's not a tedious thing.
And don't be set back by what you consider mistakes. If things don't taste right,
keep going.
Keep going. Learn. Say, oh, just do it a little different next time. And yes, the food, I often think vegetables talk to you. I understand it does that when they're growing, for one thing. Are vegetables happy? Are they in the right place? Do they have enough water? But also, as they're cooking, you can watch them. You can taste them. Is this right? Are they ready? Yeah, sure.
Well, and another thing, you know, if something doesn't taste quite the way you expected to, it may not be that you've underdone it, overdone it. You may have underdone it. Sometimes you need to add more of this, that, and the other. One thing I do as I'm kind of, you know, if I'm experimenting, I will have some little dishes, and I'll take a couple spoonfuls of something and put it in a separate dish and go, okay, now what would happen if, say, I added more mint or if I added more of this? And I'll put a little bit into a sample dish and see if I like that flavor before I take on the whole pot of it.
Oh, that's a good idea, instead of just throwing it right in the pot.
Yeah, because if you've oopsed, you haven't oopsed the whole dish. You know, you can have a little sample. It's rather like if you're going to paint a new color on the wall, you paint a sample piece to see, oh, can I live with that color? You know, so you can do little tastings along the way. I often use saucers and little monkey dishes, they're called, for that sort of thing. But the most important thing is to develop your own confidence and your own set of taste buds that please you. Because then they'll please other people.
Good idea. Good idea. One thing about listening to or being aware of the things that are variable in almost every recipe is that vegetables are different sizes. Pieces of meat are different sizes. Pieces of meat have different fat content. I have a recipe that I have given out for years at farmer's market. And the best thing about the recipe, which is makes a good product, of course, but it's the story behind it. It's leek and apple salad, and we're moving into leek and apple season. So and apple salad. Well, start out with the assumption leeks come in different sizes. Apples come in different sizes.
The flavor of apples is wide variations.
Right. So just the recipe as it would be written down or as I would hand it out at farmer's market, it says 1 pound leeks, 4 or 5 tart apples, juice of 1 lemon, quarter cup or more of chopped walnuts, and 12 to 14 ounces sour cream or yogurt, salt and pepper to taste. Well, I pass that out to someone at farmer's market, and they look at me and they look at my pile of leeks, and they say, what's 1 pound of leeks? And, well, we start looking around and weighing, and how I usually just tell people this recipe is take some leeks, some more apples, a little bit of lemon juice, some walnuts, and then mix in sour cream or yogurt until it looks right, and salt and pepper.
And tastes good.
And tastes good.
Well, and I would say that this recipe probably started off as a Waldorf salad.
I would think so, too.
Which used to be mayonnaise-based, apples, walnuts, grapes.
Celery.
Celery, probably no onions.
Oh, no, I don't think so, no. And that would be a mayonnaise-based thing.
Uh-huh.
So it's a creamy sort of thing. And it gives you the idea of putting leeks and apples together, an onion sort of taste.
So, and I would also say in this recipe, the main thing that you have to know is to only use the white part of the leek. Mm-hmm. And the sort of I would choose smaller leeks because they're going to be more tender.
Right.
Because if you're going to eat them raw, you need to chop them really finely.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing I might do is soak the leeks in the lemon juice first a little bit, like you would an onion in a vinegar. It will cut the heat a tiny bit.
I always thought the lemon juice was to keep the apples from browning.
Well, it could be that, too. So I would cut the leeks up and let them sit in the lemon juice This is just the way I would do
see,
it.
See.
Let the leeks sit in the lemon juice for maybe 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would cut up the apples and pour the leeks and the lemon juice onto the apples to counteract that browning tendency. But also I would think that the sour cream and or the yogurt, and I would use sour cream, that just sounds better to me, would stop the browning as well.
Yeah, probably. And then this recipe tastes better if you make it a couple hours ahead. It just kind of sits nicely in the refrigerator for a while. It's a good potluck dish. And I told you this had a story behind it. When I first started going to farmer's market, and actually growing leeks was 20 years ago, growing leeks was a new thing to me.
People didn't know what leeks were. They were European.
Yeah, one of them fern vegetables. Yeah. And I learned to grow them, and I thought I was doing good. But I didn't have many recipes for them. My friend Delphine Douglas here in town came up and gave me this recipe orally. Said, "You know what you can do with it?" And just told me, "Take some leeks, take some apples, make this leek and apple salad." So I did. I tried it, wrote it down because I thought other people would like it. So I passed it out at the farmer's market booth. And at the time, in the mid-90s, the man and women couple that were vending next to me, they were great Iowa State Fair goers, and they used to take things to be judged in the food competition. And good old Evelyn Onstadt, who was next to me, took this and won a blue ribbon.
Oh, she took this recipe to the state fair?
She said, "I can do this."
Well, gosh and golly, all right.
What she won in was the fact that it was the best in category for a all-Iowa-based ingredients. Because you do not have to use the lemon if you have very tart apples. So she used very tart apples. Mm-hmm. And actually, there was actually a man at the farmer's market that was selling black walnuts, local black walnuts. And if you want really,
she put black walnuts in it instead? Oh,
really
wowzers.
Good. Really good. And so she won herself a blue ribbon. So this we have a blue ribbon leek and apple salad. And I'll get this up on
I'm making mine with sour cream and black walnuts.
Sounds good to me. Sounds good to me. We'll take a little music break here. This is the button accordion player, John Wieland, with some polkas. We're back. This is KHOI Community Radio 89.1. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about recipes, how to view recipes, how to attack them, how to get good information about them, and not let them throw you for a loop. The recipes are there to help you. Don't have to follow them exactly.
Don't be a slave to the recipe.
Well put.
How's that?
Sounds like a T-shirt. That's good. That's good. Donna has been doing some experimenting with something called a shrub.
Right.
So we have the shrub report from
Donna.
Yes,
we've been talking about shrubs, and my shrubbery is doing very well.
A shrub is something to drink.
Yes, right. It's an old technique, sort of pre-soda pop, where people preserved fruits with sugar in a vinegar solution and let it age in the refrigerator. So my first shrub was a raspberry thyme, where I steeped the thyme in the vinegar, and then I mashed the raspberries in the sugar and let them both sit for a couple of days in the refrigerator, and then you mix them all together and strain them through a cheesecloth. And then you're supposed to put it in a jar and let it age a little bit so that the flavors really marry. And what is supposed to happen, and actually did happen, is the fruit flavor comes forward and the vinegar recedes a little bit. I mean, it's still tangy, but, you know, I think these recipes were certainly from the days before you could run down to the store and buy a lemon. You know, in our climates, we were not lemon-centric. This is not a Mediterranean climate, and we did use vinegars a lot. So I'm happy to report that my raspberry thyme shrub is delicious. I've had it with just club soda. I've had it just with plain water. I think next I'm going to go for it in a little either white wine or something sparkly. The other one that is still working, so I will report on that, will be the elderberry shrub. It's still in process. And this week I'm going to work on a lemon verbena and honeydew shrub. So we will get back to you about that. And if you guys have your own combinations, you know, the technique, now we're not going to be a slave to the recipe because you can be creative with what you've got in your garden. As I went, okay, I have a lot of lemon verbena, which I dry sometimes, but the brightness of the lemon verbena does not preserve well in a dried form. So I'm always looking at other ways to do this. So I'm going to try it with the shrub, and I think for the fruit, I'm going to use the honeydew because we are having good honeydews right now. I may even try it with peaches if I can get enough Colorado peaches. So we'll get back to you about that. And if you guys come up with your own shrub combinations, be sure to let us know. It's very simple. It's a cup of whatever fruit to a cup of sugar. And you pound the fruit into the sugar and let it, you know, sit because it turns into kind of syrupy thing. And eventually you will discard all of the pulp. So you want to smash out as much juice as you can. And then a cup of the vinegar. So it's kind of all equal portions. What I think I'm going to do is I think I'm going to probably put some lemon verbena in the vinegar. And I'm probably also going to pound the lemon verbena into the sugar before I put it into the fruit, because that's the flavor I'm going after. So once I've completed this process, I will report back to you again.
I like this. This sounds very assertive, pounding the
thing. Pounding, yes, we're going to pounding.
And this sits in the refrigerator to work or on the counter?
The fruit part I've been keeping in the fridge. Of course, it's cooler now, so it's not such a big deal. And I'm going to try to stick with I'm going to try using that Live Bragg's apple cider vinegar because it's got still
the mother in it.
Yes.
The live culture.
Right. So I'm trying to go for, you know, any live intestinal helpful bugs that I can keep in it.
Good idea. If this inspires you and you try out something like this, give us your thoughts at khoiradio@gmail.com. Send us a little note. Put Donald on a Kitchen or
better
DLK.
Yet, send us a little sample. We'd be happy to taste it.
See, if you have any things, experiments that turn out real well, or even some that don't, let us know. khoiradio@gmail.com.
All right, if you have a problem with it, we'll see if we can be a little sleuth here with you.
Good. Well, something else we experimented with over the past month or so is garlic scape pickles. Long about the end of July, we were awash in garlic scapes. Garlic scapes are the flower top off of garlic. And
which you cut off before you harvest the bulb,
yes,
so that all the energy of the plant then goes down into the bulb rather than into flowering.
Right. And you can do a lot of things with the garlic scapes themselves.
They're very garlicky.
They're
flavored.
Very garlic. They're kind of like the green onion version of garlic. And Donna inspired me, huh? The inspiration here. She found some recipes on what to do with garlic scapes. And I did two versions. I learned a few things. Didn't like both of them. Both of my recipes.
Yeah, we both tried this
we
out.
Learned.
Now,
we
the
learned.
Nice thing about garlic scapes is they're long and thin, and they're kind of curly. So you twine them into the jar that you're going to make the pickle in, mm-hmm, and they're really cute.
They are cute. And even serving them. I took my first jar to a potluck, actually to the Grassroots Radio Conference potluck first night. And I wondered how they'd go because they looked kind of odd for a Midwestern potluck. But I didn't get to try any myself because by the time
so
I
think
I learned. Okay, I made two versions. I made a mustard dill version, and I did that as a refrigerator pickle. Just no long-term thing. We had to just put the vinegar and a little bit of sugar and mustard dill, and there was some.
And if I remember right, that the refrigerator version was you actually poured the hot vinegar onto the
and then it sat in the refrigerator
for a month. That's I did that one.
Yeah, and then I also made a lavender and black pepper version, and I hot water bathed those. I canned those, and I actually liked those better. So that's one thing I learned. The canning kind of made them more tender, and I think it soaked up the...
Well, you had two variables here, and I have to say that was my favorite, too, because I did the lavender one...
Lavender, who would have thought?
In the cold refrigerator mm-hmm pickle one, because I like the lavender flavor, but I think that your hot bathing it tenderized the garlic scape a little more, which they needed.
Right.
So...
Right. So tenderize your garlic scape pickles, and... I would take the tail off the next time I make them. The garlic scape has a stalk, and then there's a bulb that, or a blossom that is starting to come, and then there's this long tail off the top of the blossom. And I thought that got kind of tough, although it's cute.
It's actually the blossom
it's
part,
a blossom.
Isn't it?
It's so a blossom.
It's, mm-hmm. Yeah, not strictly speaking the
it's
tail.
It's more like the head. More like
yes.
the ponytail.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think next year we're going to... be very successful. We're going to use the lavender, was it lavender mustard seed and black pepper or something like that?
Yes.
And we are going to recommend taking the ponytail off of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to recommend the hot canning. And then I think we may have perfected this recipe.
Now, see, there's a recipe that we just tore to shreds and put it back together, and it worked just fine. Good. So some thoughts on garlic, because the garlic scapes were...
Right,
mid-summer.
That was pre-season. Now we're into garlic season.
Garlic was harvested mid-summer, and now you're going to be able to find fresh local garlic.
Well, and I want you to know that I consider that Joe and Lana are some of the local garlic experts here. So listen up, everybody. She knows whereof she speaks.
Well, I've just been doing it for a long time. So or you can do this in your garden, too. Harvest your garlic and hang it in a... dry, dark place.
Away from the mice.
Away from the mice. Oh, dear. Mice got into some of them, but don't worry, folks. The rest of them are fine. Hang your garlic in a dry, dark place for at least 6 weeks. Then that means that the garlic puts on good papers. Everything dries down. The bulb is...
Papers are the...
Outside.
The skin that you kind of peel mm-hmm off before you use them.
Mm-hmm. And then... that bulb is stable. It's sleeping. It's ready to actually, I have garlic keep in a dry, dark place until way next spring. They'll start waking up long about April, May. They may start getting a little green. But they will be stable that long.
I mean, they are still alive and ready to be planted and sprout again.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to use them before they... kind of while they're still in their hibernating stage. And cool will keep the green from coming a little bit longer. And although people say that the green sprout is not good and it tastes bitter, I eat it anyway. I mean, it's less desirable for sure. And you know when you start getting that green sprout that time to use this quickly. Yes. But I don't think a green sprout is the end of the world. Now, one thing I like about Lana's garlic cloves, and this is probably attributed to the variety that you grow, which is a stiff German stiff neck called Music.
Right.
I love that. Stiff neck Germans. Hmm. And so it's called Music, and the cloves are quite large, which makes them it makes them really easy to peel and deal with. And it's not a really, really spicy garlic, but it's loaded with plenty of flavor. It's really right there in the middle. It's just about perfect. I try to buy a big supply from them about this time of year because it is really only once a year that you're going to get it. Mm-hmm. And then I keep some for using, and then the rest of it, I freeze.
Now, Donna told me about freezing, and it works just fine. So how do you freeze garlic?
Well, I had been peeling them and then freezing them, you know, in baggies to like, oh, maybe 20 to a bag or something and kind of bringing them out of the freezer.
Because occasionally you use a lot all at once, and they're already kind of halfway processed
your recipe. It's a breeze, you know. Then you can make if you're making a winter stew, you can make it really garlicky, which is always delicious in the middle of the winter. And people
That's
go,
nice
oh, this tastes so
do.
Good. And I say, well, it has a lot of garlic in it.
And then she's been chopping and peeling garlic. Oh, yes.
No, you take it out of the bag and dump it in. It's really easy.
It's nice to do it.
Now,
so,
I noticed that Lana freezes hers with the skin on.
Yeah. I figured, what the heck?
I may try that this year because I bet once it's been frozen like that, mm-hmm. the papers around it pop off really quickly.
Yeah, they do.
So you're just basically breaking the clove down, the heads down into its sort of constituent mm-hmm. cloves and mm-hmm. putting them. Mm-hmm. I'm down. Sounds like less work to me.
Less work is good. And be aware that when you thaw them out, use them immediately.
Yeah. Well, or here's the other thing I do. Once I thaw out a bag, I'll put them in the food processor with some garlic and puree them.
With some olive oil.
And puree them. So I have an olive oil garlic paste that just sits in the refrigerator. Now, this is very different in flavor from the canned garlic ground, either dried or the wet stuff that you buy at the grocery store. Garlic, once you break the clove, and the oils are released, the volatile oils are released from the clove of garlic. Once that is broken up and smashed, the degradation sets in very quickly. So if you keep it in your refrigerator, it's probably got a 2-week shelf life. But if you're buying some that has already been processed and bought at the grocery store in those little jars and stuff like that, it tastes yucky compared to what the stuff does if you make it yourself.
It's just not the same.
It's too old.
That's fine. Well, everybody does things differently, but go for the best taste that you can.
Well, it starts to oxidize, and you're just getting something that tastes like old shoes to me.
So it's
so easy to make it fresh. It really is not that difficult.
We'll take a little break here for a poem and then some more music. This one kind of helps us to remember that we're all in this together. This poem is called Routine by Arthur Guterman. No matter what we are and who, some duties everyone must do. A poet puts aside his wreath to wash his face and brush his teeth. Even earls must comb their curls, and even kings have underthings. So there, we're all in this together.
Welcome back to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about recipes, garlic, shrubs, garlic scape pickles, and now we're going to talk about tomatoes.
Oh, this is the year that wasn't. Lana and I had sort of planned on doing a whole show on tomatoes, and we kept saying, let's wait until there's the glut of tomatoes, the glut of tomatoes, which we always expect. And I have to say, we've given up. There's not going to be a glut of tomatoes this year. It was too cold. It was too rainy. And we do have tomatoes, but it's not our usual bounty.
No. There's tomatoes enough to go around for a taste, but that's about it. And folks that have greenhouses are actually probably in better shape. They're doing well if they're growing things in the greenhouse. Also, peppers and other summery sort of things are kind of, well, just not as happy as they were. But other things are doing fine. So there is time to harvest tomatoes, and there are some out there. Don't worry about it. There are tomatoes. Some of them aren't very pretty because of the weather. They tend to split and everything, but
they don't have the depth of flavor that you usually get because it's not been warm enough to generate the sugars in them. And it's also been so wet that, like with most of the fruits, I find the flavor is just kind of a little bit diluted.
They need sunshine. Mm-hmm. They need sunshine. Mm-hmm. So my big tomatoes, yes, they're there. And I've been harvesting actually quite a few and putting some up. Here's a tip. If you are gathering tomatoes, gathering them to can, or gathering them even to ripen on your counter, store them stem end side
kind
down.
Upside down.
Upside down. They rest on their shoulders a lot better than on the round soft spot. The shoulders are the strongest part
right.
of
they
the
won't,
tomato.
They won't bruise as much.
Right. So let them sit upside down to ripen, and don't put them in the refrigerator.
Yes, they're too delicate for the refrigerator. Tomatoes love heat, and they do go on ripening somewhat.
And if you put them in the refrigerator, it does kill the, I don't know what the right term for this is, but it does change the sugars in them.
Right, they don't go on sweetening.
They don't.
And, you know,
taste.
Never mind the fruit flies. Fruit flies are a good thing. It's kind of a sign that they're getting, if the fruit flies love it, it means it's getting better.
Good idea. I did have a nice harvest of a variety that I've been growing for years called Texas Tiny Tomatoes. And these are tiny tomatoes. These are beyond cherry tomatoes. They're about the size of a big fat currant, which kind of the size of the end of your finger.
I mean, you really do just pop them in your mouth. They're lovely. It's so, like a small grape even.
Yeah, they are. They're good. So there's a lot of different varieties out there. And these are intensely tomato. But it's not the kind of tomatoes that I'm going to spend years picking and putting by. They just go right in the mouth. They're too small to fuss with.
They're fun for children to pick. They're adorable.
Yeah, they are. Good thing to as I say, field can them right from the mouth, right from the vine into the mouth, into your mouth when you're in your garden. Just to graze and enjoy them. One thing I like to do with tomatoes this time of year is to oven candy them. And this is putting tomatoes by for the winter that does not require a canner. It requires an oven. And this is a recipe. Yes, Donna, this is a recipe. But, again, it depends on...
I'll give you my oral version after she's given you the recipe.
There's the heat of the oven that is going to be variable. Mm-hmm. There's what you consider a good tomato is always variable. Mm-hmm. There's the size of the tomatoes. Mm-hmm. There's how much of this, how much of that you put on. This is what you do. Oh, and I originally got this recipe from a book called The Italian Country Table by Lynn Rosetta Casper. She's on the radio giving advice. This is it's a really nice book, The Italian Country Table. And this is her recipe for oven candied tomatoes. And she talks about the result of this recipe is like money in the bank once you have some of this in your freezer, because it's really nice to pull out in the winter. She says, take 2 to 2.5 pounds of delicious, ripe, medium-sized tomatoes. Not necessarily plum tomatoes, but it depends on what I have. This is how to use up all tomatoes. 2.5
2 to 2.5 pounds of delicious ripe tomatoes. 1 cup robust extra virgin olive oil. I think that's a lot.
I do too.
And salt and pepper. My version is get out 2 cookie sheets that have edges on them.
Right. That's what I use, the half sheet pan size that fits into a normal home oven.
That's it.
And I spray it with an olive oil spray or just rub, you know, put a little puddle on, like maybe a tablespoon or two, and rub it around with my fingers. Mm-hmm. And then what does she do?
Then you cut the tomatoes so that the skin is down and the wet side is up. You want to make little cups. Small tomatoes you cut in half, bigger tomatoes you cut into quarters or even eighths. You got little tomatoes sitting on their skins with the wet side up. The trick to this whole thing is starting with a hot oven and work your way down. Start at 400 degrees for those tomatoes and bake for 30 minutes. Then turn it down to 350 for 30 minutes. Then 300 for 30 minutes. And 250 for 30 minutes. And then turn off the oven.
Let them sit.
And let them sit to mellow for 4 to 6 hours. You are getting rid of the water.
Yeah, you're
but the sugars stay. And at the end of that, you can scoop this wonderful glop into freezer bags and you are set. It's really a really nice tomato-y sauce.
It comes out kind of like tomato paste, but it still has the skins in it and the seeds in it, which I think is no big deal. And I think the whole trick with the temperature depends on how big the pieces of tomatoes are, how wet they are. I like to mix the colors so you have some yellow and some red in. Or sometimes I've even done a whole tray of yellow tomatoes, which are beautiful.
Really pretty.
Yeah. And I also, so I put some olive oil under it, and then I put the tomatoes on it, and then I... For this, I really like to use an olive oil spray because you can get an even coverage. Now, I don't use Pam. I use an organic olive oil spray because it's very flavor neutral. And then you get a fairly even coverage of the tomatoes so they don't burn and kind of seals in without making it extremely oily. Mm-hmm. And then I also tend to season my tomatoes, salt, pepper. Usually either a little crumbled basil and or oregano.
So you put that stuff. I do salt and pepper, but other things I wait until I make my recipe later. There you go. And I don't use a spray. I drizzle, and I don't care if things are a little oily. There's different ways to talk about this.
But I think the main thing with the thymy is to watch every time you turn them down. In that half an hour moment. And also, one other problem I've had with this is, you know, tomatoes come in all different sizes.
Yes.
And so some of your bigger pieces are not going to cook down as much. And if you're not careful, the smaller pieces may burn. So watch for that.
Right. This is be mindful.
Mm-hmm.
Watch what's going on. Use your nose because it smells absolutely wonderful.
Oh, it is heavenly.
Meanwhile sort of recipe. As you're doing this, meanwhile, go do something else. But set a kitchen timer or something so you will be mindful of what's going on in the kitchen.
And then afterwards, obviously you can just throw it right on some yummy pasta and eat it right away. You can spread it on bruschettas with a little cheese on top.
Pizza.
Yes. And then freeze it in kind of usable quantities. Once I've started doing this, I have never canned tomatoes since.
I haven't either. Although it's a completely different product than a canned tomato.
I love the flavor. It's so much deeper than a canned tomato.
A good thing to do with these funny tomatoes this summer. They may be different sizes. They may have some splits on them. But go ahead.
Oh, yeah. It's really good for ugly tomatoes. You just don't see that afterwards. Yeah. Now, another thing Lana is really, really good at is drying tomatoes.
Yeah. Drying tomatoes. I have a really good food dryer. Again, I oil the plastic sheets on the plastic trays.
Dehydrator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the dehydrator. And, again, you can follow a recipe, but you learn by experience how long and what temperature. And it's going to be different if it's a humid day out or if it's a dry day out. And usually tomatoes are coming bountifully when it's really humid. So be prepared to take time doing that.
Well, and I would say that candy, this is what I would call a tomato candy dehydrated tomatoes. Those are really, really good.
Yes, because the moisture leaves and
they're chewy and sweet.
Good.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
Good. So try new things. We've been talking about recipes today. And put this in your pipe as we go out and smoke it. Nasturtium leaf pesto. Try that. Take a regular pesto recipe and replace the basil.
Now, you know pesto means pounded.
Right.
Since we're talking about pounding
being
here.
Being assertive. Mm-hmm. Use nasturtium leaves instead. We tried that recently, and it's really, really
good. Now, wait.
Good.
So it was nasturtium leaves, Parmesan cheese.
Oil.
And what kind of nut? Walnuts?
Walnuts. That's it. Grind it up. There you have it.
And no vinegar. Yeah,
no
vinegar.
No. Not in that. Not in that.
Oh, okay.
No.
Salt.
Salt and pepper, probably. There you go.
It was delicious.
There you go. We've been talking about recipes. We've heard the music of John Whelan and Friends from his CD, Flirting with the Edge. Next week on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we'll talk about jams and jellies with Beth Kemp from Jumping Bean Farm. That ought to be good.
It'll be a sweet show.
We'll go out with the Low Beg Waltz. Listen to the Donna Lana Tuesdays at noon. It's repeated at 7 o'clock. Tuesday in the evening, right after Democracy Now! So you can get your meat and potatoes with Democracy Now! And come to us for dessert. This is Lana Nachtigal.
And Donna Prusgintas.
With excellent engineering by Rick Morrison. Eat good food. Enjoy life.